philosophers in
space, 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 space.
Negative. I am a meat popsicle.
Mindless philosopher, you overweight glob of grease.
I'm gonna have to science the shit out of this.
Hello and welcome to Philosophers in Space. This is episode 23. I'm Thomas. How's it going, Aaron?
It's going all right. I've set aside the small black square that I carry around with me. That constantly distracts me from everything that I'm trying to do. So I'm going to see if I can focus on this for about half an hour.
I just came up with an explanation for Andrew's audio screw-ups on opening arguments. I just realized that it's probably the handicapper general is realized that opening argument that Andrew is so brilliant on it that he has to have constant audio problems, much to my chagrin. So now I feel like there's an excuse for it, and we're just going to go with that. And if my audio is coming to you loud and clear, that's because I'm a totally, completely average podcaster. So there's no need to modify anything that I'm doing. So I've fit it in. That's the theory. We're talking about Harrison Bergeron, is this everybody.
Is this a really roundabout way for you to get Brian to like buzz me every couple minutes? Is that what you're doing here?
Yeah, no. Harrison Bergeron. And this... I'm kind of blown away by the short film we just watched that I didn't know existed until like 5 minutes ago. But yeah, this is going to be fun to talk about. It's Kurt Vonnegut. And I had seen in high school, I had seen the Sean Astin film. Well, a film, if you could call it that. I don't know why. I honestly don't even remember what class, but some teacher had us watch it. And I have a few memories from it, and I can't wait to tell you about one of them later. But then, as we were reading over this, we saw this short film that was made called 2081, which is based on the year that the short story Harrison Bergeron takes place. And it's really good, and it's on YouTube. So I would kind of highly recommend that. Or you could read the short story. It's only like 6 pages. And so either way, I think you should do that because we are obviously spoilerizing it. But it's not even, there's not really even much to spoilers because it's all about the premise. But I'm excited to talk about this short story.
Yeah, if your ears have been open to political conversations for the past 30 years at all, you've probably had the story spoiled for you in essence anyway. So
yeah,
we can't do too much more damage. Do you want to roll out the expositions though?
Oh, let's do it.
You're traveling through another dimension, beyond that which is known to podcasters. It is the middle ground between fair use and copyright infringement, between ordinary fanboying and meaningful analysis. It is the exposition zone.
The year is 2081. This is, and here's what I love, because I'm always paying attention to stuff that's probably, I don't imagine would bug you as much, but like, instantly, I'm calling BS on the premise because it says the 211th, 212th, and 213th amendments to the Constitution. And it's like, what kind of a pace did he think we were on in terms of congressional or of constitutional amendments? Like, we're not going to have another one ever. Like, it's we can't.
During the 2050s, there was a rash of them, guess, right?
Like, just like hundreds of them. Like, there's. Yeah. 211? That's not happening. I don't know what that's all right away. I'm already like, I'm done with, no, I'm just kidding. But that aside, the premise is that in the future here, these amendments have dictated that the Declaration of Independence literally meant we all need to be exactly equal kind of thing. Like everybody has to be 100% equal. So if you're too tall and strong, then you have to wear weights to kind of like weigh you down. If you're too good looking, like Aaron, then you have to wear a mask. That's why if you see Aaron with a mask, that's the reason. He's so good looking that you can't even behold what he's doing.
That's why we had Neil do our cartoon art the way that we did to balance things out.
Yeah, that's actually the mask. It's just that's that the mask. Part, that's what that's caricature. What the mask is. Yeah. And then, you know, if you're too smart, then there's like these headsets that they wear that kind of have these disrupting noises so that you can't think too clearly. So it's the way of enforcing that everybody's equal. And that's done by the Handicapper General. And it's such a short story. I mean, we could basically tell the whole thing, which is there's this one guy, Harrison Bergeron, who now I'm laughing because he's actually in the short story. He's like 7 feet tall, like strongest person ever, this incredible good looking guy. And he's played by Sean Astin in a made for TV film.
Gregor Clegane's was busy, I think, at the time, yeah. Right?
Sean Astin, who like didn't even have to do anything special to play a hobbit. Like he just was a hobbit. No offense to Sean Astin. Oh, I love him. But like, I don't even know that he needed.
No, you're
like,
right. You're right. They didn't even have to move the camera in a weird way.
It was like Sean Astin and then some little kid was like playing Frodo, like for the body shots, you know, like for the yeah, no. No, I love Sean Astin, but he is not 7 feet tall. I'll just say that. He's closer to foot tall than 7 feet tall, I think.
In his defense, I think they were going heavy on he looks like he's the smartest person in the room and not the strongest. Yeah,
okay. No, and I mean, we'll get to it, but that TV movie actually is drastically different. I think they just kind of, it was very loosely based on, you know, like the premise was there that I just discussed. Like that's all there, but then the characters are 100% different and like there's a bunch mm-hmm. of added characters and stuff, which you would need to make an hour and 40 minute movie because this is like a 10 second story. But anyway, back to our 10 second story. I love how this is done in the short film. Now, it's really blowing my mind because I just think it was so well done. This short film called 2081, which I hope you looked up and watched. It's only 25 minutes. You can get through it real quick. But anyway, the son of these two parents was like taken away. And when we're introduced to these two parents, the dad is like kind of trying to remember it, but can't because of his headset thingy. And tell me if it's different in the story, but that's essentially
pretty much
like
the same.
Yeah, like, that's kind of
what's getting buzzed.
Right. Yeah, that's kind of what's going on with the dad the whole time. And then all of a sudden, they're also watching a ballet on TV, and all the ballerinas are like wearing the stuff to make them all kind of average and that kind of thing. And then it's interrupted because Harrison Bergeron has escaped from prison. And he's older now. I guess he was kidnapped when he was 14. And he like goes and takes control of this ballet, and the TV broadcast kind of hijacks it. The important part is that he essentially casts off his big, you know, burdens, his giant weights that he has to wear around and the stuff like that. And he's making a point. He also has planted a bomb below the stage. And he's making a point that, you know, we should all cast off our things to make us average. And what's interesting, the difference between the story and the short film is in the story, he seems to be just like some megalomaniacal, you know, like thinks he's Jesus figure. Cause he comes in and he's like, mm-hmm. I'm your emperor. Like, listen to what I say, which is kind of weird. And then he takes like a ballerina and is like, you're the empress now. And it's like totally it. I don't even understand. I mean, I kind of get some of the critique that he was making, the author was making on that, but it also seems a little different. I like in the short film, he's hijacking the whole thing just to say like, hey, let's stop doing this to ourselves. You know, like, well, I think anyway, it seems like that's his point because on his bomb, he's written live free or die and that kind of thing. And anyway, in the short story, the end is essentially that the handicapper general storms in and just shoots them both. And that's basically the end. And like the dad kind of watches the whole thing on TV, watches the whole thing unfold. But then in the end, his headset thing is so disruptive that the wife is like, oh, what just happened on TV? And he's like, I don't know, something sad or something, you know. So that's essentially it.
I love this, and I there's so much content in that such a short story, and it's had such a lasting impact, I think, on the discourse, which is so interesting to me.
Yeah, well, what do you want? There's a lot to talk about. What do you think? Yeah. It's so weird that, what do you think about that difference where the, you know, Harrison Bergeron in the short story seems to be some sort of you know, almost like a cult leader-y kind of guy. Is there anything more you can put on that?
Yeah, so I want to start by talking about how this story is like one of those really good pieces of art where you can debate the meaning and the interpretation. And I think there are two possible interpretations, and they kind of directly oppose each other in the sense that there's the very sort of popular known interpretation that this story is basically just a parable of the horrors of equality of outcome being enforced upon a society right. by a fascist kind of government, and the right has picked that up and run with it as that kind of parable, right? But I also
which I think is the equivalent of how right wingers loved Stephen Colbert.
Exactly. Kinda, it's exact same like that. Thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, 100%. It's Poe's law run amok, it feels like.
Yeah.
Because there's also a very strong, I think strongly supported by the text interpretation that socialist Kurt Vonnegut was in fact doing a send up of the right wing.
That socialist BS. Kurt Vonnegut was not in fact trying to support like Ayn Randian, like free market
that he was
capitalism.
Making fun of
Yeah.
So I think what I love about the story is that it is such a good satire of the thing it is trying to satirize that it makes one wonder if it is so good at it that it also raises a legitimate concern, or is it really just a warning that this is a very weak way of understanding this kind of perspective? And so I think that, to bring it back to your question, the reason I think that Emperor stuff is in the original is part of the farcical, over-the-top, satirical nature of the story, the same way that they're described in the end of the short story as jumping so high that they fly and literally suspending themselves in air because they are so super uber-mensch individuals compared to everyone beneath them. I think what Vonnegut was doing there was making fun of the Ayn Rand kind of view of the Superman who will, you know, throw off the shackles of society and tower above them and be like unto a god for them. And that's no better than this silly attempt to over-acquire equality by oppressing everyone to the lowest common denominator.
Yeah, I get the sense that the short story is way more tongue-in-cheek and like kind of poking fun at a lot of stuff. Whereas the short film that I also think is really good, but I think it kind of has to go a different way. And maybe that probably explains the difference in the character choice, because I think that the short film is probably more directly trying to just be like, don't let anyone tell you that we all need to be equal, and don't let government and like government telling you what to do or any sort of fascistic kind of overreaching, you know, whatever entity that's telling you what to do. It's kind of a protest against that. And so the Harrison Bergeron, who's played by Armie Hammer, is just an anti-government, you know, activist kind of thing in the short film. So I think they made that choice that way because it's very well done, and it's very serious, you know, in a way that the story I don't know is, but I could be, correct me if I'm wrong.
No, I absolutely agree. And it's why I think it's a really great version of one of the interpretations of the story, but it's not a complete translation of what I consider the dynamic tension of the story as being sort of both a critique of a little bit of leftist kind of state-run systems, but also a much larger critique of that what the short film in a sense glorifies. That's the problem, I think, right? If you want to criticize that short film, it's that it's glorifying something that Vonnegut in the short story clearly doesn't want to glorify.
Yeah, right.
Where Harrison Bergeron is not any better in any kind of way.
Yeah. What I see the short story as, or... Yeah, I guess the premise itself, I guess it's so that applies to the short story and the short film. What I see it as is the instant straw man that conservatives go to whenever you're trying. So like, you know, I'll be on Twitter saying like, hey, maybe we should give people health care, like maybe not let poor people die in the streets. And then someone will be, oh, so Mr. Equality of Outcome over here, he wants Harrison Bergeron. Like, it's basically that. Like, it's just any argument you try to make of like, hey, maybe all this economic inequality is really bad, the instant snap. Oh, so you want every, what about short people and tall people? Did you know that short people have it way harder? And it's like, okay, I get it. Like, everything isn't going to be 100% equal, but we're really unequal right now. Like, there's so much inequality. Maybe we just move, you know, closer down the line toward some sort of equality. If we move a little bit, that would be nice.
Yeah, if it makes you feel any better, William F. Buckley apparently published this in his newspaper as something that conservatives should latch onto as well all those many years ago. So it's really? Like, yeah, nothing has changed.
Oh, I didn't realize that. So it's like,
yeah, I think I read that in one of the articles that we'll have in the show notes. They commented on the fact that this was picked up unironically at the time by conservatives who were like, see, this is what the liberals really want.
Wow, that's funny.
Yeah, yeah. But I think, you know, I think the strongest argument against that, and then I want to talk a little bit about this equality of opportunity versus outcome argument, because I do think that is an important philosophical topic. I think the strongest argument against their kind of naive, conservative, non-satirical interpretation is that, or misunderstanding who's being satirized, thinking that the left is being satirized when really it's the right that's being satirized by this story, is that the really over-the-top portrayals throughout the story. Like, for example, that, like, the story doesn't even make sense for the six pages that you're reading it. Like, this society would fall apart instantly, unlike a satire like Brave New World, where I genuinely believe that that could last 300 years if it's calibrated properly. Like, the version of equality that is trying to be accomplished is a obvious straw man from the start, because there's ridiculous. So many things that aren't being, you know, taken care of in this attempt to quote unquote make everyone equal.
Well, it would cripple your economy. Like, there's you can't, it's insane. No state would ever do this to itself. Like, it's right, obvious. Right. It's so obviously ridiculous that to look at it, I agree with you, like, to look at this as any sort of serious, like, oh, you know, omen of the future to be right, worried about.
Cautionary tale. Yeah,
exactly. Like, it's, I think that it very, that is very much how people take it, though, often. Mm-hmm. Doesn't it seem like?
Yeah.
I mean, do they take it as just like, well, sure, it's an exaggerated version, but the, you know, someone might interpret it as the point is, this is the danger of trying to make everybody equal kind of thing.
Yeah. And I think the strongest interpretation is this is the danger of misunderstanding that when we say we want to try to help people have better equality, that what we are going to do is we're going to put chains on people and heavy weights and buzz them in their ears so that they can't do any of the important jobs we need them to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, like, I think we should talk a little bit about this idea, because people, I think, don't necessarily know the lingo of equality of outcome versus equality of opportunity. Right. So the basic idea here is we're trying to achieve a more equal society, with the idea being that in a functional, healthy, liberal society, everyone has access to all the same potential opportunities, and whoever works hard and tries to achieve will succeed and achieve and do well. That's the goal, it seems like, for a fair and healthy society. And so that's achieving what we would call a quality of opportunity. And then there is this concern that this will take the form of trying to achieve a quality of outcome, where we will set rigid quotas that will require that these number of this type of person be fit into every specific kind of job.
Right.
And that, like, certain people be held back so others can feel like they are equal, and sort of generating an artificial sense of equality by enforcing, like, you know, lowering everyone to this lowest common denominator. So,
yeah. I've had to have this. Well, this gets thrown at me all the time. So if you aren't familiar with this annoying straw man retort, then that means that's good for you. That's nice. But that that means you don't argue with shitlords on Twitter or on debate stages as much as I do. And that's also good. but yeah, no, this actually featured prominently. I didn't really think about this ahead of this recording, but this did feature prominently in my debate with Carl back at MythCon, which was the fact that anything I try to outline as inequality, he would just that's all they do. The retort, if you're somebody who is pro status quo, if you're a status quo warrior, is to just say, whoa, you're trying to get equality of outcome. And they think, and this is, it's unfortunate because this really is, this isn't a straw man. Like, this really is what a lot of people think. They think that the minute the laws were like set right, you know, back in the 60s and early 70s with the Civil Rights Act and like voting rights and stuff, like 2 days later, like, okay, that's equality. Everybody, it's equal. All the laws apply. That this is even one of the arguments they think they have is they'll be like, name one law that it tells you that I can, you can do something and I can't, or something like that. It's just this stupid thing. Like, tell me one law that says women can't do something that men can, or whatever the heck it is. And it's absurd. Like, obviously, that can't be true. Like, if you really think that after, you know, the second the ink was dry on the Civil Rights Act, then, oh, we're good. Everything's good. All equal. Then that's absurd. Clearly, there's more that goes into it than that. And my retort was that you measure outcomes to try to determine, to give you a good indication of whether or not you have equality of opportunity. Like, how would you know?
Right.
So I
agree with most of your...
There's never been a female president or something like that, or there's been one black president, or there's whatever, name the thing. If you're looking at those orchestras and there's just like all white people forever, you know, it's like, when I say, oh, I think we should, you know, there should be better representation in these things, or there should be more diversity, it doesn't mean, like, they interpret it to mean, oh, I just find some unqualified person of color and just put them someplace they don't belong just because I want equality of outcome. And it's like, no, I think you can measure, you can look at the outcomes that are happening and make some educated guesses as to whether there really is equality of opportunity. Okay, end of rant. Go ahead.
So for our fives of listeners who might be concerned about the other side of this position, I do agree with most of what you're saying, but I want to steel man them a little bit more, since even though they do not do us the favor, we will do them the favor, right? So the first point to make, I think, is, like you said, even if equality of outcome isn't the goal, it is often a metric that is pointed to by people who want equality of opportunity to say, look, there's some evidence here of lack of equality of opportunity. And I think you're right that it is that kind of evidence. But I think that makes it a more problematic data point to use on its own. I think the solution here, and I think you brought this up in the Sargon debate and he failed to respond to it, is the idea that we can measure equality of opportunity in real ways. So, for example, the colorblind or the name change studies, right, where you find that if you just change the name on the same resume, you get a different outcome. That's a clear problem of equality of opportunity, not equality of outcome. And you're not measuring it in terms of how many female CEOs there are, female presidents there are. You're measuring it in terms of the fact that when you ask individuals, would they feel safe with a female CEO or a female president, or how do they respond to these particular images or these sounds coming from these individuals, that they have a variety of biases that are preventing even the possibility of trying that person out in that position.
Right.
That makes some sense. So, like, I think that we can listen to their critique up until the point of saying we can't base our entire argument on statistics about equality of outcome, because that might give the impression that the only right outcome would be one with none of those kinds of statistics. Whereas I think we can all agree that if at the end of the day we had achieved what we felt like was gender equality and racial equality and equality of opportunity was resolved, but the number of people in every individual role was still, you know, not exactly equal, that would be fine.
Yeah.
Right.
No, I agree. And the other thing is it's consistently used. And even just looking at economic inequality, I've had, you know, conservatives on my show in the past. I haven't for a while, but in the past, it would be like, well, it's just impossible to get economic equality. It's just, you can't do it. And so it's essentially like, if you can't get perfect equality, then you shouldn't try at all, kind of thing, is another part of the straw man. And I think what is so frustrating is that once again, merely wanting some things like healthcare, like some better programs, that kind of thing. It doesn't mean you're putting weights on everybody and putting like, you know, these yeah. headsets on that'll be, it's just look at the charts, just do a quick Google search for how economic inequality has gotten worse in this country over the decades. And you'll see that it's at like all time highs and we just passed an absurd tax cut. So like just not passing that absurd tax cut would be like one thing I would say would be like a tiny step to not making economic inequality even worse.
Yeah. And I think that it's pretty easy to dispel the straw man of liberalism as being this desire for radical equality of economic outcome. Most liberals these days are John Rawls-style liberals who will agree to the idea of some amount of economic inequality so long as it benefits everyone. And anybody who wants any more background on that, go check out our last episode of Embrace the Void where we went into Rawls a bunch.
Nice.
And I also think this is another point where we can say, look, Harrison Bergeron is obviously a satire of the right wing's view of what the left would want for equality, because they totally leave out any sort of economic equality.
Yeah.
Right? They don't even talk about the part where she says at one point, oh, well, that guy tried, and they don't have it in the short film, but in the short story, she says, oh, the announcer tried really hard there. He should get a big raise. So there's clearly
I think that is in the short film.
Did she say that line specifically? I thought
yeah,
they might have.
Yeah, she did.
They trimmed some of the lines for dramatic effect in the short film, which I thought was a great
job. They changed
job.
It instead, like in the short story, he hands off the bulletin to like the ballerina to read, I think.
Yeah.
But in the mm-hmm. in the short film, since that doesn't really make any sense, he hands it off. Like the guy has a stutter and can't read the news, and he hands it off to like the cameraman or something who reads it perfectly. And then the wife is like, well, he tried, the other guy tried, he should get a raise. But anyways, what was the point you were making about that?
Just that this is very in the time of the short story, which I think was like 61 or something, that like the equalities that have to be solved are things having to do with intelligence and appearance, but economy, wealth inequality sort of gets a pass.
Interesting is it's always mind-blowing, you know, how much that I and I'm sure a lot of people listening, like you watch stuff and you think of it in your time, you know, you think of this story and the morals and the messages and you relate it to what's going on now. But like in 1961, that's such a vastly different time from now. And it's interesting to try to think what he would have been trying to say. I know in the article that you sent me, it talks about how maybe what Vonnegut might have been writing about was the sense in the 50s that everybody kind of had to have this same kind of American image and this, you know, they all had to fit in a certain way. And it might have been more geared toward that. Because economic inequality was actually way better back then. Now maybe it still seemed bad to people at that time, but that could also be a reason why that's not really even addressed that much in the story.
I think you're right, and I think another reason that we can say there is some sincerity, the reason that he's so effective at the satire, I think, is partly because he's sincere about his fear of government enforced uniformity. He is a socialist, but he is a wild hippie socialist. And there are a lot of his stories. I think he is critical of the idea that you would limit people's freedom of expression in various ways. So I do think that he genuinely is concerned about holding people back artistically. He just doesn't think that this is really the way that liberalism would play out if it was given free rein.
Right. I agree with that. Another thing I was going to mention is that was just funny and it's always stuck with me just for fun. I was going to talk about the Sean Astin movie that I watched literally, you know, in 2002 or something. But it's what's always stuck with me is in that one, it's hard to remember the details, but he has a different job. I think he works for TV and like there's these like government videos I think he works on or something like that. And he kind of similar to the ballerina thing and the taking over the stage, he does a similar thing, but with the state TV, you know, Mm-hmm. And then he takes over the state TV and then like goes on, makes some political speech or appeal or something like that. And then what happens is, and what's always stuck with me, because I actually kind of like this part of whatever they did for that movie, which was they, you know, they arrest him and somehow they like convince him to go on again and recant what he said. So the plan, the government, the Big Brother type plan is to have Sean Astin back on the TV and say, hey, look, that clearly this was meant to be a spoof. It was just kind of a War of the Worlds situation where people took it seriously and they shouldn't. And then what ends up happening in this movie, spoiler alert, is he's making that case and he's like on the TV and he's like, yeah, and that's how you know that I was just kidding. Like, I wasn't serious, is that I'm here today. And then like what ends up happening is in the middle of talking, he just takes out a gun and shoots himself on TV.
Oh, jeez.
And that's dark. How they decide to end. And that's how they decide to end it. But I just always love that like choice that Sean Astin's making, this choice of like, oh sure, I'll go on and like apologize, you know, and pretend it was fake. And then he's just like, screw it, I'm just gonna like do like the maximum damage I can to try to break this spell that everybody's under. And again, it drastically changes the meaning of the story. But mm-hmm. that always stuck with me for some reason. I was always like, yeah, that's kind of, I don't know, something about that like writing choice was like, no, I kind of like that for some reason.
Yeah, I like the dark endings of the story. I feel like in any version that you get, there's still going to be that kind of, if they do it right, especially because you get the cut back to the parents who, mm-hmm. you know, immediately forget what happened.
Yeah.
And like the... Especially if they do a good job, like they do it in the short film, they do a really good job making you emotionally engaged with Harrison and stuff. And then it's over in a flash.
Right.
You know, and there's a horror to that that I feel like is very yeah. Black Mirror.
I was, you know, it's so funny. I was just going to say, I love this short film. I wish it had been a Black Mirror episode, like, you mm-hmm. know, but it has great production, but I don't know who saw it. You know, I don't know. I've never heard of it. I don't know who watched it. It was probably for some little film festival or something, but I think it was really well done. I think it should have gotten a little more credit, but you know, I'm looking at the clock here, Aaron, and we're mm-hmm. at time, but we've got an announcement. We've decided to make some adjustments. What we did on patreon.com/0G, what we've done over there is we made a bunch of goals for patron goals and stuff we were going to deliver, and then we like you guys too much, so we just did it anyway without reaching the goals. So that's pretty much what we did because we love the yeah. show and we love doing it. But admittedly, that's not a very effective incentive for anybody because we just kind of caved on all our... It's like we made demands like, we've got you hostage. Give us money and unmarked bills and a helicopter. And then the police are like, or just give us the hostage. We're like, yeah, you're right. Here you go.
We really like the hostages.
Yeah, we were never gonna do it. But what we've decided to do is we'll kind of adjust our goals, and because the main thing that we want to do with the show is do more of it, and that's, I think we hear that from you guys too as well, rather than being a half hour, which again we also kind of cheat that from time to time, but it's supposed to be around a half hour. At the 300 patron level, which we're at 211 right now, so it's within sight, the 300 patron level, we'll go ahead and extend to 45 minutes plus that extra at least 15 minutes of after dark time that you always get. So that's what we're going to do. Just wanted to announce that. So if you're on the fence, you know, and you want to go and pledge $5 a month, you know, it'll go toward that goal and maybe we could extend the show.
Absolutely. And we would love to. There's so much to cover in a lot of these pieces. And yeah, because we're just getting so many messages with things that you wanted us to see a little bit more about. Stuff like, you know, why didn't you get to Alan Arkin in Gattaca, even though I love Alan Arkin. But there's so much to cover. We only did one episode of Gattaca because, you know, Thomas said we could only do one episode
because
of that.
Guys,
so we could make some more room for Dune episodes because he just
Dune
wants to do Dean all
the time. Three times better than Gattaca is by the metric of our show. I realized this before recording, and I was like, we did three episodes on an incomprehensible movie. But Gattaca, brilliant, brilliant piece of art. We one episode.
Imagine how much stirring things to get fans you would get in that extra 15 minutes is what I'm saying. There'd be a lot of trolling back and forth here about how Seinfeld is terrible.
Oh,
let's be honest.
You
it was
too?
Not even really that good at the time.
You too? Oh, jeez.
So we love doing this, and thank you all so much for supporting us. And if we can get to that 300 patron goal, we will extend the episodes and we will start thinking about some fun goals for after that.
All right. Well, we've got to thank our top patron, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
By we, I mean you.
So here's what you can get with your Patreon dollars, right? At $50 a month, you can get me to say something that is objectively false, like the following statement. I, Aaron Rabbi, hereby state that Picard is the best captain. Clearly a false claim. Not even one of the two best captains.
Whoa.
But whatever, right?
Can
I'll
you not
say it,
make
right?
us lose our top patron, please?
Whatever you want, right? If you want me to say that Me Too has gone too far, I will say it in the least plausible delivery of any non-Canadian
professor. I love how you went to that.
We're
having some good, clean fun about Star Trek, and then you go to this like awful political thing.
I'm just saying, selling out is hot these days, and at that patron level, I will say things that you can then cut and paste and ruin my life with later. It's fine, right? I'm not going to live that much longer anyway.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you so much to our top patron for making Aaron say things. That's one of my favorite parts of the show. Somebody else jump up there and make Aaron say more stuff because it really is fun. But with that said, we also need to give a little sneak peek of what we're doing next week.
Yep. So next week, the better winner of
Dune
the
part four.
Tie. You never
sorry,
got that.
Sorry, I just couldn't. Yeah, I had to blurt it out because I'm so excited for Dune Part 4.
Hey, you know there are a lot more books to that series and miniseries, and there's a lot of things we can cover. Plus, Villanueva is going to be doing a two-part Dune movie series coming out that you're definitely going to have to talk about with me. So,
oh, God.
Get ready for that.
Okay.
But for next time, we are going to do Minority Report, which was the other popular topic that we put forward. So we're going to talk about Minority Report and the immorality of pre-crime, and we're going to see how your utilitarian chops hold
Ooh.
Up.
Yeah, that's going to be an interesting... I feel like we might do some fighting in that one. That could be fun. We'll do some do some debating.
I can see It'll the future, like, and we're definitely going to do some
fighting.
You
can ask me, you know, if Phoebe, if there's pre-crime, she's, you know, the what do they call them? It's been a while since I watched that movie, but the...
Precogs?
The precogs, yeah. If the precogs see that Phoebe's going to be a mass murderer or something, you know, that'd be a tough one. Yeah. Why don't you have kids that I can pressure your... that I can really pressure your philosophical commitments with? You have it. You need what's your most precious thing? You got a pet or a?
Do you have a science fiction movie that proves that we have free will? That would be pretty devastating.
Yeah, but I'm saying I want to be able to ask hypotheticals, like what if your pet? Do you have a beloved?
Oh, what do I care about?
Yeah, what do you actually care about?
Oh, yeah, puppies are good, and
okay,
my wife, those are two
sure,
things, and
okay.
my parents.
What if your
right?
wife is, yeah, okay, so we'll, that'll be what I'll have to do.
I'm not a dead-eyed sociopath. Why would anyone say that I'm a dead-eyed sociopath?
God. All right, we've got to get over to After Dark. Thank you for listening, and once again, go to patreon.com/zeroG and join us in the extra bonus time, but if not, we'll see you whenever we see you.
That's all for the main show, but if you'd like to go to patreon.com/zeroG, you can enjoy Philosophers in Space After Dark. Here's a little sneak peek for you.
Is that affected? Is that philosophy affected at all by the fact that you're doing something to someone in Harrison Bergeron versus... selecting certain embryos that are going to have certain characteristics? You know, it's before
huge can
I think
of
we
worms.
Would all
it's a huge can of sperms.
This has been a burst transmission of Philosophers in Space. All music written and performed by Thomas Smith. If you've enjoyed your infotainment upload, please locate the nearest podcast interface device and fill it with 5-star ratings and glowing reviews. If you think Ground Control should spring for fun new goodies and content, consider supporting us at patreon.com/zeroG. You can find us on Twitter at zeroG Philosophy, where Aaron will instantly and compulsively respond. Or you can email us at philosophersinspace@gmail.com. Finally, if you're sad that it takes so long for our signals to reach Earth, you can always find Thomas over at Serious Inquiries Only and Opening Arguments, and Aaron over at Embrace the Void. Until next time, live long and philosopher.
Oh, I want to go in.
All the way in.